바라봐 근자비하리. 고피자나바라바 기리바라자리. 고피 자나바라바 기리바라다리. 야쇼라 난다나 라자자나란다나 야쇼라 난다나 브라자자나 란자나 야무나 티라 바나자리. 야무나 티라 바나자리. 하레 크리스나 하레 크리스나 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 하레 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 라마 하레 라마 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 하레 하레. 옴 나모 바가바테 바스데바야. 옴 나모 바가바테 바스데바야. 옴 나모 바가바테 바수데바야. 바 Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 6th canto, 1st chapter, text 40. So, text 40. Yamaduta uchaha uchuhu. Veda Veda pranhito dharmo ya dharmas tad viparya. Veda narayana sakshat svayam buriti shushma. Yamaduta uchuhu Veda pranito dharmo dharmas tadviparya. Veda narayana sakshat svayam buriti shushma. Veda pranito dharmo dharmas tadviparya. Veda narayana sakshat svayam buriti shushma. Veda pranihito dharmo dharma tadvipayaya. Shrira Narayana Sakshat Svayam Bodhiti Shushuma Yamadutta Uchahu. The order carriers of Yamaraj said, Veda, by the four Vedas, Sama Yajurveg and Ratarva, Pranitiha, prescribed, Dharma, religious principles, He, indeed, Adharma, irreligious principles, Tat Viparaya, the opposite of that, that which is not supported by Vedic injunctions. Vedaha, the Vedas, books of knowledge, Narayana Sakshat, directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead, being the words of Narayana, Svayambhu, self-born, self-sufficient, appearing only from the breath of Narayana and not being learned from anyone else. Iti, thus, Shushruma, we have heard. Translation? The Yamadutas replied, that which is prescribed in the Vedas constitutes Dharma, the religious principles, and the opposite of that is irreligion. The Vedas are directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana, and are self-born. This we have heard from Yamaraj. Purport. The servants of Yamaraj replied quite properly. They did not manufacture principles of religion or irreligion. Instead, they explain what they have heard, what they had heard from the authority of Yamaraj. Mahajano yena gata sa pantaha. One should follow the Mahajana, the authorized person. Yamaraj is one of the 12 authorities. Therefore, the servants of Yamaraj, the Yamadutas, replied with perfect clarity when they said, Shushruma, we have heard. The members of modern civilization manufacture defective religious principles through speculative concoction. That is not Dharma. They do not know what is Dharma and what is Adharma. Therefore, as stated in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, Dharma prajito kaitavo tra. Dharma not supported by the Vedas is rejected from Srimad Bhagavat Dharma. Bhagavat Dharma comprises only that which is given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bhagavat Dharma is sarva dharman parityaja mamikam sharanam raja. One must accept the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrender to him and whatever he says. That is Dharma. Arjuna, for example, thinking that violence was a dharma, was declining to fight, but Krishna urged him to fight. Arjuna abided by the orders of Krishna, and therefore is actually a dharmi, because the order of Krishna is dharma. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Vedaischa sarvair aham eva vedaha. The real purpose of Veda, knowledge, is to know me. End quote. One who knows Krishna perfectly is liberated. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 4:9, Janma karma chame vittivyam evam yo vittitatvataha dityaktva deham punar janma naiti mam iti sorjuna. Quote, one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in the material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Arjuna. End quote. One who understands Krishna and abides by his order is a candidate for returning home back to Godhead. It may be concluded that dharma, religion, refers to that which is ordered in the Vedas, and adharma, irreligion, refers to that which is not supported in the Vedas. Dharma is not actually manufactured by Narayana, as stated in the Vedas, asya mahato bhutasya nishvasitam eta yad rig veda iti. The injunctions of dharma emanate from the breathing of Narayana, the supreme living entity. Narayana exists eternally and breathes eternally, and therefore dharma, the injunctions of Narayana, also exist eternally. Srila Madhvacharya, the original acharya for those who belong to the Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, says, Vedanam pratamo bhakta harir eva yutto vibhu ato vishvatmaka veda ityahur vedavadinaha. The transcendental words of the Vedas emanated from the mouth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the Vedic principles should be understood to be Vaishnava principles, because Vishnu is the origin of the Vedas. The Vedas contain nothing besides the instructions of Vishnu, and one who follows the Vedic principles is a Vaishnava. The Vaishnava is not a member of a manufactured community of this material world. A Vaishnava is a real knower of the Vedas, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Vedaschaya Savar Chasavar Aham Eva Vedyaha. Okay. So, we're starting the Yamadutta's reply to the Vishnu Dutta's questions. The Vishnu Dutta's asked four questions to the Yamadutas. The first one being, what is religion and what is irreligion? What is dharma and what is adharma? And then, the reason they're asking these questions is because they just stopped the Yamadutas from taking the soul of Ajamil. And they were taking the soul of Ajamil because they thought that he was sinful and therefore he was subject to punishment. So the Vishnu Dutta stopped that, and I guess to test their understanding, they asked the Yamadutas some questions about what is religion, what is irreligion, what is the process for punishing, who is punishable, and are everybody who engage in fruitive activities, are they punishable? So the Yamadutas are replying to the first question in this verse. So we'll explore this topic of what is dharma and what is adharma today. And it's appropriate too, because today is the appearance day of Lord Ramachandra. And he's known for coming to exhibit and demonstrate perfect behavior in doing prescribed duties. So he always follows the Vedic injunctions. This is what he's known for. He's like the perfect son, the perfect husband, the perfect king, and he always follows the Vedic injunctions. And here we're learning that dharma means to follow the Vedic injunctions, to that which is prescribed in the Vedas. So Lord Ramachandra was the ideal example of this. Now there was one... Of all the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra, there's one pastime which might cast a shadow of a doubt as to Lord Ramachandra's ideal behavior in following the Vedic injunctions. And this pastime was when he killed Vali. So Vali is the king of the monkeys, and he's got a younger brother whose name is Sugriva. And Vali and Sugriva were actually demigods who appeared in Lord Ram's pastimes as demigods in order to assist in Lord Ram's mission. So Vali was the king of the monkeys, and Sugriva was there, and they were very powerful monkeys. They had mystic powers and all kinds of things. One time, there's this demon named Mayavi, I think, who came and challenged Vali and Sugriva. And, you know, I guess wanting to fight with them. So Vali and Sugriva got really angry, and they started to charge at Mayavi, who's this very powerful demon. And then when Mayavi saw Sugriva and Vali approach him, you know, in anger, these big, huge monkeys were running, charging at him. He's like, "Ooh, maybe I shouldn't have done that." So then he kind of bolted in the other direction, and he was running away from Vali and Sugriva, but they were on his tail. So then Mayavi ran into a cave, and Vali and Sugriva were at the mouth of the cave, and Vali told Sugriva, "Wait here. I'm going to go in. I'm going to deal with this demon. You just wait here, and then I'll come out after I'm done dealing with him." So then the Vali went inside the cave. They were duking it out in the cave for over a year. And then after a year passed, Sugriva heard this loud scream coming from Vali inside the cave, and then a pool of blood like exiting out from the mouth of the cave. So Sugriva thought, oh, Vali got killed, you know, because he just screamed like a blood-curdling scream, and now blood is coming. So he concluded that the demon killed Vali, and in order to prevent the demon from coming out of the cave, Sugriva took a giant boulder and tried to, you know, block the cave so that the demon couldn't come out. It turned out that that wasn't the case, but rather Vali killed Mayavi, and that blood-curdling scream was actually a roar of victory. So when Vali was trying to go out of the cage, you know, the cave, he noticed this huge boulder there, and he thought, what's going on here? And then when he somehow ended up moving the boulder, he went back to the kingdom, he found that his younger brother Sugriva was the king, because they needed a king, and Sugriva was the next in line to become king. So Vali concluded that, whoa, Sugriva, he purposely blocked me, you know, locked me into this cave so that I would die there and so that he could become king. So there's this misunderstanding that Vali had with Sugriva. And Sugriva said, no, that's not what actually happened. I didn't, or what he tried to explain, but Vali didn't hear it. He didn't entertain any kind of explanation. He just immediately publicly humiliated him, banished him from the kingdom, and he took his wife and made his wife his own wife. So this is obviously improper reaction to an innocent mistake by Sugriva. But nevertheless, so now Vali's king again, and Sugriva's banished from the kingdom of Kishkanda. So this is the kind of the background needed. So now to Lord Ram's involvement in this whole story. When Lord Rama was searching for Sita, he came across Sugriva, who was an exile from the kingdom of Kishkanda. And he asked Sugriva, I could really use some help searching for Sita. Would you help? And Sugriva said, well, I'd love to help, but I could only be really effective if I'm the king of Kishkanda, because right now I'm banished from the kingdom and I can't even leave this area, otherwise who knows what my brother will do. So Lord Ram came up with this, I guess, plan. He told Sugriva, you go and you fight with Vali. You engage in combat. And then I'll also be there, and I'll hide behind a tree. And when you guys are engaging in combat, I'm going to shoot an arrow and I'm going to kill Vali. So this seemed pretty, you know, from especially from the viewpoint of ethics of combat, this seemed pretty sketchy, immoral. Like, how could you do such a thing? Especially Lord Ram, who's known for being very moral and virtuous and everything. Sugriva agreed, but at first he was a little hesitant because Vali is much more powerful than Sugriva. Vali is actually Indra, coming in Lord Ram's pastimes, and Sugriva is the sun god. So at first he was, because Vali also got this benediction that whoever he fought, he got their powers. So Sugriva knew he couldn't win. He knew he couldn't beat Vali in a fight. But because Lord Ramchandra said, you should do it, then he did it. And anyway, so that's what happened. And then right as Lord Ramchandra fired the arrow from behind the tree, you know, Vali got hit and he was mortally wounded. And you know, at first, Vali was, before the fight happened, Vali had got some advice from his wife, Tara. His wife, Tara, told him that maybe you shouldn't fight Sugriva this time because I heard that he made friends with these two brothers from Ayodhya, Lord Ram and Lakshman. And because they, because now Ram and Lakshman are on Sugriva's side, you might not want to fight Sugriva. He was given this advice by his wife. But Vali said, oh, I mean, I know Ram is a virtuous person. He won't disobey the orders, you know, the ethics of conduct of battle. And plus, I have no enmity with Ram. There's no reason he should interfere with my fighting of Sugriva. So I really have nothing to worry about with Lord Ram being there. Whether Sugriva made friends with him or not, it doesn't matter to me. So he didn't take the advice of his wife, and he ended up fighting, and he ended up getting shot by Lord Ram. So when he got shot, he asked Lord Ramachandra, like, what did you do? Like, why did you just shoot me? This is like a treacherous act that you just did. You know, this is obviously against the conducts of the codes of fighting, and this is very immoral behavior. This is especially not fitting of a person of your stature. Like, how could you do this? He said, I think you've kind of become contaminated because of your association with Sugriva. This is why you did this. So Lord Ramachandra responded, well, you don't understand the intricacies of Dharma. Dharma is quite a complicated thing, or complex. So Lord Ramachandra then began to explain why he did that. You know, first he said that I'm a servant of Bharat, who's the king at that, you know, Lord Ramachandra's younger brother, who's the king of the place at that time. So I'm the servant of Bharat, and it is my duty to protect the righteous and to punish those who do injustice. You have unfairly banished your brother to the forest, and you've taken his wife. This is punishable. This is punishable by death. So this is one reason why I killed you like this. Another reason why he killed him like this is because Vali is a monkey, and he behaved irreligiously. And for Kshatriya, they can kill animals from like behind the tree or on a tree. They don't have to directly engage with the animal, Kshatriyas, when they're hunting. So it's okay to kill animals like the way Lord Ramachandra did. And since Vali's a monkey, it's okay. So this is another reason that Lord Ramachandra gave as to why he killed Vali like that. Another reason was that because Vali apparently got some benediction from the demigods that whoever he fought with, he would get half of their power, so that no matter who he fought with, he would always win, because he would get half of their power plus whatever power he had, so that no matter what, he would always be stronger than his opponent. This is kind of like his subtle trick to become immortal, kind of like how Hiranyakashipu said, I want to become immortal, I can't do that, okay, so then of all these stipulations about how I can't be killed. So Vali kind of did something like that too, where he got a benediction that was roundabout way of being immortal. So Lord Ramachandra could have just directly fought with him in battle and killed him anyway. I mean, whether he got that benediction or not, it didn't really matter for Ramachandra. But what mattered for Ramachandra was that he wanted to uphold the benedictions given by the demigods. You know, similarly how Nrisimhadev killed Hiranyakashipu, he didn't have to kill him the way he did, but he did that so he can uphold the benedictions given by Lord Brahma. So similarly, Lord Ramachandra didn't directly engage with Vali because, if, you know, according to the benediction, Vali would get half of Lord Rama's strength, and therefore he would be more powerful than Lord Rama and could kill him, but obviously that's not the case. So that was another reason why Lord Ramachandra didn't engage Vali directly. And then the last reason that Lord Ramachandra killed Vali was because it was ultimately for his benefit. Because he did sinful activities or something, by being killed by the Lord, he got relieved of those sins. In fact, Lord Ramachandra said that, okay, even if you still think that I'm, you know, unfair for killing you in this way, because he just got stabbed with an arrow and he's dying, and Lord Ramachandra is explaining all this to him. And then Lord Ramachandra said, okay, even if you agree that, or even if you think that I'm still unfair having killed you like this, I will give you back your life right now, and you can go back on living and everything will be a-okay. And then when Vali heard these reasons, especially, you know, how Lord Ramachandra could give him back his life, he had a transformation of heart, and he ended up surrendering to Lord Rama right then. And he said, I'll have so many lives that I'll live, but how often will I get this chance to meet death like this, you know, with you right here? So let me die right now with in your presence. That would be more glorious. And then he, you know, praised Lord Ramachandra, and he ended up, and then he left his body. And then another benediction that Lord Ramachandra gave Vali, because it really, you know, it's many people have trouble with this pastime because they think, oh, Ramachandra was so unfair. He ended up, he also gave a you know, for just to put the cherry on top and to show his magnanimity, he gave Vali the birth, and his next birth or births after that, he gave Vali the birth of Jara, who was the hunter who ended up killing Krishna, well, shooting an arrow at Krishna's feet, and that being the catalyst for Krishna and wrapping up his pastimes here on earth. So, which kind of seemed just, like, okay, as I'm killing you, I'll give you an opportunity to also, quote-unquote, kill me. So, therefore, it again shows Lord Ramachandra's righteousness. So, when we, this is like kind of one example kind of pertaining to how Lord Ramachandra always upholds Dharma. Well, in fact, he's the embodiment of Dharma. Whatever he does, it's religious. He can't do anything. He can't do a Dharma. Whatever he does is religious. So, Dharma is an interesting, I guess it's intricate, as Lord Ram said. There was this one club at my school, the University of Illinois. It was a Hindu student organization, but they called themselves Dharma. They had this title for their organization. And I went to one of their meetings one time just to kind of see what it's all about. And they were, at that meeting, they were talking about what is Dharma. You know, like they go around and they ask, it was like a philosophy discussion, and the topic of the day was, what is Dharma? And, you know, everybody, if you ask, what is Dharma, they'll give you a bunch of different answers. So they were going around, and I think a lot of them answered, well, Dharma, at least my Dharma, is to be a student, to be a good student, to excel in academics, to study, and this is my Dharma. And everyone went around and said what they thought Dharma was. And so this is the idea, what people have when they hear the word Dharma, like, oh, I'm a student, or my Dharma is to study, I'm a husband, my Dharma is to get protection, whatever they think. So there's many different kinds of dharmas that are mentioned in the Vedas. There's just the general idea of dharma is given in this verse as being that which is prescribed in the Vedas, and a dharma being the opposite of that. But there's also dharma which pertains to the body, and there's dharma which pertains to the soul. So the dharma which pertains to the body is like sarva dharma, you know, in the sarva dharma parityajya verse. All the dharmas that are manufactured by man in order to make the society go on properly. These are all the different dharmas. And within this category, there's jati dharma, pashu dharma. So jati dharma is like family tradition and family obligations and duties that arise from family responsibilities. And there's pashu dharma, which is just eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Then there's svadharma, which is one's occupational duties within like the varnashram system, like brahmana, kshatriya, vaishya, sudra. There's a kind of dharma which is mentioned here in this purport. It's manodharma. I don't remember where it is, but it's manodharma. It's just, oh yeah. Members of modern civilization manufactured defective religious principles through speculative concoction. So this is called monodharma. It's speculation, mental concoction. And then there's dharma, samstapana, which is just religions that are not in line with devotional principles. So these are all kind of in the category of dharmas which relate with the body. And then we're more interested in those, that dharma which relates with the soul, like, you know, Sanatana Dharma, Paro Dharma, Sad Dharma, Bhagavat Dharma, Yuga Dharma, you know, different terms which all mean like, oh, there's also Manava Dharma, which is Dharma, which is just doing what Krishna says. So there's all these kind of dharmas that deal with directly engaging in devotional service. And they're not so much this kind of dharma is not like an injunction, it's more of like a constitution of the soul, this kind of dharma, It's just constitutionally who you are as a servant of Krishna. So there's one. In this verse, there's this little interesting. There's a couple ways you can look at it. One way of looking at this verse is that we should only be doing the activities that are prescribed in the Vedas. And that is dharma, and everything else, it's a dharma. It shouldn't be done. We should only, whatever the Vedas say, that's what we do only. Another way of looking at this verse is that we say, well, we can do things that are not prohibited by the Vedas. Sounds like we're saying the same thing, but it's a little different. One is saying that I'll only do what the Vedas say. And another is that I'll do things, but I won't do things that are prohibited by the Vedas. So there's kind of like two ways of looking at it. Because in the verse it says, that which is prescribed in the Vedas constitute dharma, therefore everything else is not dharma. So I'll only do that which is prescribed in the duty, which is talked about in the Vedas, everything else I will not do. And then in the purport there's also, Prabhupada says that, a dharma, irreligion, refers to that which is not supported in the Vedas. So not supported doesn't necessarily mean not enjoined. So it's like a subtle, two different ways of looking at this. So like, one way is that I'll only follow what the Vedas say. So this is, there's a school that kind of follows this line of thought. It's called the Karma Mamamsa school. They say that everything in the Vedas is like an injunction. You don't even really need to understand what is being said in the Vedas. You just have to know what you should do and do it. And if by doing that, then you can, you know, be progressive. So this is kind of like a conservative way of looking at the Vedas, where you just only follow what the Vedas say and nothing else, like by the word. So this gets into like the meanings of words, and they study like whatever grammar and everything is very like, I want to know exactly what the words mean and what I should do from these words. And there's like a whole study of how they can understand what the Vedas say. So that's one way of looking at it. Another way is a little bit more liberal way, that okay, well, the Vedas, maybe trying to understand the principles mentioned in the Vedas, but maybe not following them word for word as it is, but like, okay, we're in a new situation now, and some of this might not apply in my situation, and there's a lot of things that the Vedas don't talk about, especially nowadays, that is going on, so how am I going to deal with all the stuff that's not talked about in the Vedas that's going on now, if I'm, you know, unless I can understand like a principle and apply the principle in the modern day context. So like a good example to illustrate this, these two ways of looking at things is like the example of gay marriage. So nowhere in the Vedas will you find anything mentioned about gay marriage or homosexuality or anything. The Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, it's just not talked about. So the Karma Mamamsa folks, or those who are more conservative in general, they'll say, well, you shouldn't do it. There's no such thing as gay marriage there, so therefore you shouldn't do it. It's not prescribed in the Vedas. They'll say, no, it's against the Vedas, it's adharma, it's don't do it. you know, like there's a joke when Ramapad Maharaj is giving class. He said, I guess somebody called the temple and asked, you know, can you guys conduct gay marriages here in the temple? You know, I would like to get married, and can you conduct our marriage here in the temple? And then I guess Maharaj was saying, well, you know, we don't know the mantras for that. So that was a funny response, but it kind of gave the idea that, okay, well, it's not really, we don't know, it's not condoned, so therefore we don't do it, in a sense. But then there's like a liberal way of understanding gay marriage, which, okay, the principle is undenied that, you know, we shouldn't engage in illicit sex, and that sex should only be for the purpose of raising Krishna-conscious children. So this should be the only purpose of any kind of sexual relationship with another person. But there's this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, text 33, which says that even a man of knowledge, he knows, he acts according to his nature. So everybody has a nature according to the three modes of material nature. So what will repression accomplish? So if you just happen to be born with a nature, like a, you know, a nature of like a homosexual nature, you know, some people might use that verse and apply it to this situation. Well, what will repression accomplish? So they might say that in order for the gradual reduction and elimination of sinful sexual activities, they might say, they might encourage those people who, you know, may be homosexuals, and they were engaging in illicit sex outside of marriage, and this is obviously not a good thing and not condoned by anybody, but they might encourage such a person to say, okay, you have this nature, at least get married, have to another man, sure, or if you're a man, then to another man. At least this is one step better than where you were, and it's progressive. And it's with the ultimate goal of ultimately reducing and eliminating illicit sexual activities. So some might come to that, you know, they might use the spirit, like reasoning like this to justify how gay marriage could be encouraged. Obviously, it's not ideal, but it can be encouraged in this way, kind of looking at it from a more liberal perspective. But the karma of the monks was they would never allow such a thing like this to happen. They would say, no, this is definitely not allowed. And also, another good example which can illustrate this kind of dichotomy here is like voting for political elections. Vedas don't say anything about voting. There's no mention of like democracy mentioned in the Vedas anywhere, so there's no strict rules and everything for, okay, you should vote like what you should be thinking about when you're voting, because it's not something that they did. So Karma Mamamsa folks, they would say, well, you shouldn't vote because that's not prescribed in the Vedas. But somebody who's more liberal, they might say, well, voting is kind of considered like a social responsibility. And if we don't vote, then we'll look very irresponsible, and we look like we don't have a civic conscience. So we might detract those thoughtful people who maybe are into these things, and they might think that the devotees are just irresponsible, and therefore they won't vote, or therefore they don't really take them so seriously. And also, you know, Prabhupada, he actually used the democratic principles and like forming the GBC. There's like a vote. There's democratic principles there. They vote on different resolutions. And he also said that we can use democracy to, you know, in Krishna consciousness. The idea with democracy is that the people vote for their leaders. So if we can make everybody Krishna conscious, then they'll vote for Krishna conscious leaders, and then we'll have a devotee as the leader. You know, so Prabhupada was using it, being a little bit more broad-minded, saying, okay, we can actually use this in Krishna's service. So this is kind of two ways one can look at this verse. Of course, it gets, you know, sometimes it can get very complicated. There's, arguments, especially when you, like, sometimes if you look at the Shrutis, what to speak of the Smritis, that they'll say things which seem totally contradictory and irreconcilable. So it's not always easy to know. And a lot of people like to argue from the scriptures, they'll say, and they'll be very passionate about a certain issue, and they'll use the scriptures to support their stance. And then someone else might use the scriptures to support their stance on the same issue, but for the opposite side. And then people who don't have very much realization, they like to argue like this, and they really like being right. So they're not so much interested in what is the truth, they're more interested, this is the way it is. So then they're just stuck in their position. So, but the real solution, I guess we can come to, is described here as Mahajano Yena Gata Sa Pantaha. One should humbly submit and follow the Mahajanas. They say that real religious principles is in the cave or the heart of those who are self-realized, the Mahajanas. So we have to seek out self-realized persons and hear from them. Just like the Yamaraj heard from the Yamadutas heard from Yamaraj, who is a Mahajana, and therefore they're repeating what they heard, so they replied quite properly. So similarly, if we hear from Mahajanas, we can clear up these hazy areas, I guess, in our understanding. Okay, so that's what I have today. Is there any comments or questions? Yes.
Thinking about when you're explaining the different kind of dharmas, that sometimes a conflict could come up if somebody's applying some dharmic principle that's meant more for the soul, whereas somebody else is applying a dharmic principle that's meant more for the body or community. Like one common example is the Brahmachari ashram, especially if you're from an Indian family. So then they often make this point that no, but it's your dharma to take care of your parents. But then the higher principle is to surrender yourself to Krishna. You know, So like that, this conflict then comes up. So what would you say?
Well, Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Prityaja Mamekam Sharanam Vraja. So, next question. Anything else? Karnanidhi Prabhu?
Srila Prabhupada wrote in his purport somewhere that a person, how he becomes gay, because when he is involved with so many sexual activities, then he becomes, you know, immune, means, you know, impotency. So that leads to become him gay, you know. So there again, where is the question of gay marriage? They are sexual inabilities. So it is also against our Vedic principles. That's what you told, no? In order to putre sudara, to beget a son, one has to accept the wife. Or else there is no relationship with wife. So according to Vedic scriptural injunction,
we don't fully understand support. Everything that you said, and you might have to repeat. Right, so the Vedas, when they don't say anything about that. The only thing the Vedas really, there's one example in the Srimad Bhagavatam of when Brahma was creating the different living entities. There's this one entities that come from the buttocks of Lord Brahma, and then they ended up, you know, they were males, but they ended up being attracted to Lord Brahma, and they went to go try to chase him for sexual enjoyment or something. So Prabhupada says something like, and then there's further detailed ways of looking at it, like, well, they were actually attracted to the feminine aspect within Brahma, because the acharyas say like that for women, right? Like that, yeah. So that's the only about this topic. So, yeah. I mean, that's the only thing mentioned in the Vedas, I guess we can... I mean, there's also the example of, what was the other example of King Sudumna, who was cursed to switch gender every month or something, from a male to a woman and like that. He had to go, but he was the king also, which made it really awkward. And the citizens didn't like that, the fact that he changed genders like that so much. And he was ashamed. He felt ashamed that he had to switch genders. Other than that, there's not much written about. Right, so it's hard to say. Something else?
Seems like there's I get a sense of an irreconcilable difference between like the law and the spirit of the law. That's kind of what I was hearing from your discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like the law, and then there's the spirit behind it. Mm-hmm. And some, the more liberals, you know, terming them liberal, they kind of stick more to the spirit of the law, and so they seem to make certain external adjustments which mm-hmm. may not be appreciated by those who stick more strictly to the law. And ideally, it seems like, if possible, there must be some middle ground where both ideas could perhaps be harmonized and everyone could be happy. But I just get a sense of a sort of irreconcilable difference on trying to maintain the balance between these two.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to get others to reconcile. I mean, if you become self-realized, it doesn't really matter about all these issues. But to get everybody to agree on a certain way of looking at a certain issue, that'll be tough because they're really stuck in their way of thinking and their way of doing things, and they're interested in only being right and not the truth. So what to do? Right, but if you hear from the Mahajanas, they're not so concerned with these things. I don't know. Okay, Jitendra Prabhu. Yes.
Srila Prabhupada was always adjusting a situation. I remember Allen Ginsberg, you know, he was a kind of a gay person. Not kind of.
Kind of
a flaming one. And Prabhupada told him, you should go out with women. So I thought that was a good adjustment. But he said later on that we shouldn't waste too much time with this fellow because he's kind of a nonsense, you know. He's, you know, and then we saw him later in the airport, and he says he's not into Krishna anymore, he's into polytheism. Shortly thereafter, he passed away. Another thing is, one devotee was wanting to leave his wife, and Prabhupada said, no, you should stay with her. And then Prabhupada changed his mind. He says, yeah, you can leave her. And then they asked Prabhupada, he says, well, why did you, give him that, prescribed method mm-hmm. of dealing with the situation? And Prabhupada says, well, he would have done it anyways.
Yeah, that's a good example.
That would have been a more of an offense.
Right, so that's a good example of Hare Krishna. The more liberal way of, at least in this analysis today, is the more liberal way of seeing the Vedic injunction. The Vedic injunction is that you do not divorce your wife. But here Prabhupada said that you should in this case. So right, so there's more like a principle there. Yes.
We were having an interesting discussion yesterday on this point about it's interesting, in this whole pastime, the Yamadutas are considering that Ajamila is actually sinful, but because he's been chanting the holy names of Narayan, he's actually free of sin. And externally, although it appears that he's acting sinfully. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about this point, about how, you know, even in this purport, Prabhupada is making the point that what is Dharma? Dharma means surrender to Krishna. It doesn't mean some external manifestation of really good character or something like that. It's really more of an internal state. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about this, that we may often sometimes see something that looks to be very, very religious, very, very good, but internally the person may not actually be very dharmic, or vice versa. Internally they may be very dharmic, but externally they may not have very good character. It seems like it's an important point that, because often, at least I've experienced, we often stress a lot on like good behavior externally, you know, but the internal point about surrender to Krishna may be getting missed.
Well, we're not Yamaraj. Yamaraj can mentally observe all living entities. He knows what they're... He's practically like Paramatma. He can understand the mentality of all the living entities and their whole situation under what modes of nature they are, what impelled them to act in different ways. And he knows all of this. And because he knows all of this, he knows what the proper punishment is for different living entities. And therefore, he has the proper perspective about whether this person's doing dharma or adharma or what. Us, we don't know what the heck's going on in another person's mind or anything. We can see what they're doing externally, and that may or may not be dharmic, but we have no idea. We can't punish, like, so that's why being a manager is so difficult in spiritual institutions, especially if you're, I find it very difficult, because how can you punish anybody, really? Especially devotees, because they're chanting the names of God, and they're surrendering their lives to Krishna, and the Yamadutas, that, you know, they're being told that they're sinful, so what can you do? How can you punish somebody? It's very difficult. It might be your service that you have to do that, in which case you have to get advice and act under guidance. Sure.
Really, it's this point you're making about how Yamaraj can actually see the internal states of all entities. He knows what is actually going on with them. So if that's the case, then why did he send the Yamadutas?
First and last. But Yamaraj, he understood the principle. He always understood the principle. He always understood that the chanting of the holy name can relieve one from all sinful activities, it seems. Yes, so he knows. And it seems also that the Yamadutas were following the orders of Yamaraj. So it seems like Yamaraj told them to do this, in one sense. Which is, I know, right, because I've also heard that the Yamadutas, they just made a mistake. You know, because they were given certain rules, general rules by Yamaraj to deal with different living entities, but they didn't know. Yeah, right. Right. And they just made a mistake, you know, which is, well, you know, like that.
Hare Krishna. If a devotee dies in a neophyte state of consciousness, will Yamaraj and the Yamadutis pay him a visit?
Well, if he's a devotee, even if he's a neophyte devotee, he's chanting Hare Krishna. So because he's chanting the holy names of God, Yamadutas won't go near them. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki, Lord Ramachandra ki.